Well, hello. This is another episode of STR Ask. It's so much fun. I'm here in studio. My name is John Noyes. I'm a newish speaker with Stand to Reason. I'm here with Greg Kokel. How's it going, Greg?
Hey.
I'm trying my best to fill in for Amy Hall, but I think it's nearly impossible, actually, because Amy's incredible. But I'm having fun doing it, and I'm having fun because of the questions that are coming in.
By the way, she's just out of studio for a couple of shows. She'll be back. No worries.
She will be back.
And maybe John will be back, too, if he's a nice boy.
We'll see how these episodes fare, so see if anybody actually listens to them. The first question that we'd love to dive into is by Ken, and he wrote us asking, in The Story of Reality, page 115, you say, in quotes, only a sinless man, and in quotes, only a man who is more than a man could pay for the sins of multitudes. Mm-hmm. If asked, how could I explain why this would be so? Mm-hmm. Why can't we pay our own debts like we usually do?
Oh, well,
it's a great question.
You can. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. We are all under a guilty sentence, and we are facing a kind of execution, so to speak. I want to be careful how I use that, because we don't disappear, not in my view. But the point is we will. And when I characterize this with people, I just put it very simply. I said, either Jesus pays or you do. That's it. You say no to Jesus. Okay, well, now you're going to stand before the judge. In fact, we have a good picture of that in Revelation 20. People standing before the judge, and the books are open. Yeah. I call them the books of death, because what they deliver is eternal death, not eternal non-existence, but eternal separation from God and eternal punishment. And they are cast, those whose names are written in that book and who are judged according to the works, that is, those whose names are not in the book of life, but are merely in the book of death, as I put it, because that's the result, they are tried and found wanting. So the answer to the question is, yes, it's certainly going to be the case that people are going to pay for their own crimes. What I was describing in the book is the rescue, essentially, that there has to that the only way we can be rescued from our slavery, this is another way of looking at it, and this is a way that the scriptures put it, in fact. A slave cannot rescue himself. Slaves are purchased by someone who is not a slave, who pays a price. By the way, this biblical word that captures that notion is called redemption.
Yeah.
Redemption means payment of a price to bring someone out of slavery. All right, so that's the picture there. A slave can't buy himself. He's got nothing to pay with. Another slave can't buy another slave. They got nothing to pay with. They're all in slavery themselves. Someone on the outside has to do it, or else they stay in their slavery. In a similar fashion, to be able to purchase someone's redemption, again, following a very similar concept here, you have to be someone who has something to purchase it with. Okay? The people in debt are in debt because they don't have what they need to pay their debt off. They are going to pay their debt off through punishment in the long term. For someone to pay the debt, they have to have something to pay with, and they can't be debtors themselves.
Yeah.
So Jesus is sinless, so he is not in debt. And he led a perfect life, so his virtue can be applied to those who he purchases. There's an exchange that goes on there. He ends up taking our debt, and we take his what's the word I'm looking for? Like lots of money, his excess, his riches. He gets our debt. We get his riches. Okay, and so the reason I put it the way I did in The Story of Reality, that why don't you read that line again? Only someone who's not in debt. So go ahead.
It says, okay, only a sinless man and only a man who is more than a man could pay for the sins of the multitudes.
So what I've said so far addresses the point of being sinless. That is, you have to be somebody without a debt of their own. But remember, what Jesus does is gives his life to pay the debt of everybody. Well, no individual human being, even if a mere human being is sinless, has the resources to pay the penalty for everyone.
Yeah.
This requires a special kind of individual. At least this is the way the argument goes. And it requires a man, but someone who is not simply a man. There's a kinship redeemer. Human beings were supposed to do right. They were supposed to manage the world. They were broken. Who purchases them? Another human being. A human finishes the job. That's the concept of kinship redeemer. But it can't simply be a mere human. It's got to be somebody that's more than a human, ergo the God-man.
Yeah, he's got to be outside of the mud, so to speak. He has to be clean and outside in order to pull you up out of it.
And he's got to be, when you think about the punishment for a person's crimes against God is eternal separation from God. So that's a never-ending punishment. And it's done with multiple people. Millions, billions maybe. I don't know the actual number, but lots.
Yeah.
Okay. So how could any one man in a finite period of time pay a price that is adequate to cover the infinite or the never-ending punishment of a multitude? And this is where we get into, this is where the God-man part is important. There is an important piece that was written by Anselm, Why the God-Man? And also, that's about 1,000-ish. And St. Anselm, Curdus Homo, Why the God-Man? And there was also another by Athanasius called The Incarnation, On the Incarnation. And so these are ancient works by very thoughtful men that provide some more information on these issues.
That's fantastic. I love in the story of reality how you explain these things in non-theological terms. Like, this is propitiation is what we've been talking about, right?
Right.
And
where God is satisfied. What will it take to satisfy God's anger and wrath against the sin we've committed? And that's the propitiation.
Yeah.
He is propitiated. He is satisfied.
And I love the language that you use in the book specifically, and you break it down in ways that I think even like the question here is like, how can I explain this to somebody else? And it's I feel like when we use this type of language, story language, you know, it's a man, mm-hmm. and then it's the God man, and you place it in those terms, people can grasp it.
Well, this is why I think the redemption language or the slavery language is helpful, because a slave can't buy himself.
Yeah.
You know, and one slave can't redeem another slave. It's an outsider. So that's part of it. That's part of the explanation. And that's the way, I think, one of the best ways to explain how this works, at least one aspect of it.
Awesome. And Ken, thank you for that question. We're going to roll on to Steve's question. And he says this, he's asking, I'm reading the Bible cover to cover for approximately the 13th time.
Good for him.
Whoa. Some stories are unbelievable.
More than me.
That's a lot. That's a lot. Some stories are unbelievable. Genesis 32:22, man wrestling with God and God cannot overtake him. Numbers 22, donkey talks. Judges 15:15, Samson kills, 1,000 men with a jawbone. 2 Kings 2 curses youth and 2 bears kill 42 youths. And he goes on. And I tend to believe the Bible, but really, these stories seem, if I can say this, silly and unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I think that I like this question. How can he believe? Are these stories meant to be believed as truth, literally happening?
Well, I don't call them stories. I call them accounts.
Okay.
And because I think that they are represented as things that actually happened. Okay, and I could go through every single one of those if I wanted to, but just as a couple of examples. Because what is important for a person to understand, and I put it this way in the story of reality, but and I have time to explain it more, but I'm just saying it right now, and I think you'll be able to make sense of it, is that we actually live in a magical world.
Yeah.
It isn't the world of materialism, where nothing exists outside of matter and the forces of nature. We live in a magical world. There are powers beyond us. There are powers within us. There are powers outside of us. They are supernatural powers. All kinds of things can actually happen that seem to be, to many, features of fantasy. All right. Now, the appeal I'm making here, John, is not that because I say we live in a magic world, then all of these magical things actually took place. That's not the appeal I'm making. I'm saying that this is a book that describes events that took place that are completely consistent with the kind of world that the book is set into. All right? So nobody says when they read, just for example, when they read The Lord of the Rings, they don't say, man, this idea of the Uruk-hai, man, coming out of mud, oh, man, that's just unbelievable. Because they understand that the stories have to be assessed in light of the world that the setting is in, yeah. Right? And it's also fiction. I mean, I guess a person could say that. But the point I'm making is that in those worlds, those kinds of things happen because they're consistent with the ontology of the metaphysics of that world, all right? And indeed, sometimes books or novels or stories fail because they break their own worldview rules. They do things that are not consistent with their worldview. These are flaws. So now we look in the Bible, and all of the things that were mentioned, for Samson killing all these people with the jaw of a bone, and the jawbone of a donkey, et cetera, et cetera. These are all things that are certainly possible in a miraculous world.
Absolutely.
Okay, a supernatural world. It certainly is possible. Now, whether it happened or not, that's another question, but you can't simply dismiss it by saying, oh, that's just bizarre. It's bizarre if you're an atheist. If you are judging the biblical events by an atheist worldview, well, then it is bizarre.
Yeah.
But that's not the fair way to assess it. The question is, and this is where I think we should go from, I used to call it top-down as opposed to bottom-up, but that's too confusing of a language. I'm talking macro and micro. We have to start with the macro. We have to start with the big picture. We have to ask ourselves, does the kind of world that the Bible describes actually exist? Mm-hmm. Is there a God? Does he intervene into the effects of men? Can he make a difference in the events of history? Can he visit the planet himself in some form, and even in human, in not just human form, but in an incarnation? In the past, in scriptures, you see God presenting himself in human form, but that's just the visuals, if you will. But the incarnation is something different. He takes on humanity to himself in Jesus of Nazareth. Are these the kinds of things do we live in a world like that? Do we have reason to believe that those kinds of things actually take place? I think we do. And so when you set yourself in the world that actually exists, being a world like the Bible describes, then these other events are much more credible. Okay, it doesn't mean they necessarily happen just because now they're credible, but what I'm saying, that's another step, but what I'm saying is you can't simply disqualify them because they seem incredible to a materialistic worldview. This I do talk about in The Story of Reality, the mistake of assessing one worldview's qualities based on what a different worldview requires, unless you've already established that that different worldview is true. It's the way the reality is, and then you're really measuring these claims by reality and not merely by your worldview. So the one part that may require a little more explanation, John, or just a word or two, is when the angel is struggling with Joseph, and Joseph doesn't, and the angel doesn't prevail. Well, I mean, and so how could God not prevail over Joseph, okay? Same way that my wife didn't prevail over my daughter yesterday when she was wrestling around on the couch. It's part of the match. It's part of the game.
Yeah.
It's part of the interaction. It's just the way it works. And God was trying to accomplish something in particular there, and so he's condescending in that circumstance. Could he have done differently? Sure.
Yeah.
He chose not to. He chose to go through this whole thing because he was accomplishing something in the life of Jacob, who became Israel at that point.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points. I appreciate this question a lot because I like how he says, I tend to believe the Bible, but really. And my question is like, well, what helps you believe a certain portion of it, and what What has you doubt certain portions of it? You know, if we serve a God who created everything out of nothing, I mean, he spoke everything into existence, whatever that even looks like, he can pretty much do any. I mean, that is more right. miraculous than any of these things that you're
yeah,
talking about.
Yeah, the rest is just small potatoes kind of thing. And in the beginning, everything was created. You know, God created the heavens and the earth. And I mean, like, bang, there it is.
Yeah.
Well, if he can do that, then he can do anything. It's like probably, you know, a guy who has a gold medal, an Olympic gold medal in weightlifting could probably carry your luggage upstairs. What
exactly.
Do you think? Yeah.
Yeah. And he could make any of these things happen. But it's a great question. And it's one that I think is there's something to it that makes me think a lot of us, when we think of our worldview has become kind of synchronistic with a materialistic worldview,
yes, uh-huh.
where we adopt a materialism without even realizing it, mm-hmm. on top of our Christian worldview.
Let me offer a procedural point at this point, because it's a point I've made a number of times in different shows, but I just want to make it again. And that is, there is a difference between defeating a defeater of your view and affirming your own view. Okay, so oftentimes what comes up for us is people are tossing out something that they think is a defeater. Well, your view can't be true because of this, or this, or this is unbelievable. You can't explain it, whatever, and so they're trying to defeat our view. If we can parry the defeater, that doesn't affirm our view. It just shows that our view can't be defeated in that way, and a lot of these are just parrying the defeater or defeating the defeater. Okay, it just means that our view is not vulnerable to that objection.
Yeah.
Maybe vulnerable to another one. So I don't want anybody to think that I am somehow trying to prove Christianity because I parry these objections. It's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to show that these particular objections are not going to work for the reasons that I give. That's all we're doing here in many of these cases, including the one we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's really good advice. The another question that's been sent into us by John Michael Workington, he's asking, how can I respond biblically or logically in a sound way when someone argues for a postmodern, and he qualifies postmodern with reader-responsive way of reading the Bible, and make it say things the author didn't intend? So it sounds to me like he's wondering, how can you argue with somebody about the authority of the scriptures when they come at it from a postmodern perspective where it's the reader who brings meaning to the text?
So what you say to that person, I'm really glad you're now a Christian. What do you mean, I'm not a Christian? Oh, yeah, you are. You love Jesus. Where'd you get that from? I just got it from what you said. Yeah. I never said that. Well, that's the way I read it.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I'm done is taking the roof off in kind of a snarky way. Although it's not really snarky, it's a good application. I have actually done this with audiences, and the whole audience in this particular case was dead silent. And then they couldn't figure out what was going on. And then I said, well, at least that's the way I interpret what you say. And then everybody started laughing.
Yeah.
Because the point I'm making is, it is obvious to everyone that the reader centered approach to language is false.
Yeah.
Because you can't even learn there is a reader-centered approach to language if there is a reader-centered approach to language. And the approach that we're talking about is this postmodern view that meaning is in the mind of the beholder, so to speak. Meaning happens when a reader reads text. It doesn't matter what the writer had in mind. All that matters is what the reader's getting out of it. And, of course, this is so-called like living constitution approach to jurisprudence or constitutional law. It is also what happens for a lot of people when they go to the Bible. But they don't want themselves to be read
Sure.
that way, or their words, spoken words, to be, in a certain sense, read that way. And all I'm sharing with them when in the example that I gave, taking the roof off, taking their approach seriously for the sake of discussion, and then giving it a test drive. And I drove it right between their eyes in that particular case. This is obviously false.
Yeah.
It's obviously false. There are certain genres of literature in which we are free, in a certain sense, to take something away that the writer didn't intend. And that's because the writer writes in a fashion that allows us to do that. Maybe poetry, maybe certain type of fanciful works. But most of the time, people are communicating something from their mind to yours using the medium of language.
Yeah.
And that's why there are standards about the way words are used and grammar is used so that this act of communication can be successful. And so what this approach, this postmodern approach, says is that that's not even the way it happens. Here's what's really going on. Oh, really? So how am I to take your words, your own words? Can I just interpret them any way I want? Oh, so you affirm my view. Thank you. No, I was denying your view. It does not matter what you were doing with your words to me. It only matters what I'm doing with your words to me. See, there I'm applying that rule. It's nonsense. But it's amazing how people who write about that expect to get a royalty for what they've written.
Yeah. And they write long books on it.
That's right. Yeah.
Which they intend people to take seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the way, if that way of looking at language is sound, you can never complain that somebody took your words out of context or is misrepresenting or twisting your meaning.
Yeah.
That can never be done because those notions are tied to a classical understanding of the writer or communicator reader kind of relationship. If that relationship isn't in place, then things like taking things out of context and twisting someone's words or misrepresenting them or misunderstanding them are all meaningless concepts.
Yeah. I was having a conversation once with a family member who buys into postmodern thinking and specifically this idea that we bring the meaning to the text, and let him raise a ton of objections. And at the end, I just said to him, I said, you know what? I actually agree with everything you said, except why do you like to torture puppies?
Yeah.
Like that's, except for the torturing puppies, I'm with you. And he's just, he lost his mind. He's like, that's not what I said. Don't twist my words.
Yeah.
I said, whoa, wait a second. This is how I'm taking you. This is what I'm understanding you to
I'm
say to me.
I'm playing your rules.
Yeah.
Brother.
So let's play in your, like we said before, you know, our story allows for certain things. And we're talking about our story. We have access to those things like a supernatural realm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to enter into taking the roof off, right? I'm going to enter into somebody else's world to help them see, hopefully help them see how oftentimes it's absurd,
right?
These things. So thank you for that, Greg. And with that, we are going to end this episode of STR Ask. As always, you guys can go to Twitter and get us your questions, and we'd love to answer them here. Make sure you add the hashtag STR Ask, and we'll make sure we do our best to get the questions up here. And this is John Noyes standing in for Amy Hall with Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.